Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome, everyone.
Great to be here. Today we're diving into a real giant of Western thought, Augustine of Hippo.
Absolutely. And specifically, we're looking through the lens of Henry Chadwick's superb introduction, Augustine, a very short introduction, though we're drawing from his broader scholarship too. Why Augustine now? Well, his ideas about self, society, sin, grace, they're still echoing, aren't they?
They absolutely are. I mean, you can't really understand Western philosophy, theology, even psychology without grappling with Augustine. He laid foundations we're still building on or maybe arguing over. Thinkers from Aquinas to Luther, even someone like Descartes, they're all in dialogue with him, knowingly or not.
And Chadwick is, well, just the perfect guide for this. A giant herself in church history, Regius professor at both Oxford and Cambridge, he knew this material inside out.
Right. And what Chadwick does so well is connect Augustine, the man, his struggles, his life, with Augustine the theologian. He shows how the doctrines came out of lived experience. It wasn't just abstract thought.
So our mission today for you listening is to kind of distill that. We want to pull out three core struggles that really defined Augustine and made his work so enduring.
What are they?
Okay, first, his personal struggle, that raw self-analysis in the Confessions. Second, his struggle with the church as an institution fighting the Donatists and Pelagians.
Big theological battles, yeah.
And third, his struggle with history itself, especially after Rome fell, leading to the City of God. We're trying to see, you know, what made his thinking stick for 1,500 years.
It's about understanding ourselves, our institutions, our place in time, really.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with Augustine the man, the restless heart.
Right. Before the saint, there was Aurelius Augustinus, born 354 CE, the gas to North Africa, modern Algeria.
And Chadwick paints him as this brilliant, ambitious young guy, a master rhetorician, top-tier public speaker, persuader, maybe even like a celebrity intellectual of his day.
Definitely ambitious. But also torn, wasn't he? Between his pagan father, Patricius, and his very devout Christian mother, Monica. That tension seems core to his early life.
And let's not forget, he was living a pretty full-on sensual life, too. He had a long-term relationship, fathered a son, Adeodatus, outside marriage. He wasn't starting from a place of purity.
Not at all. And intellectually, he was searching everywhere. He spent, what, 9 years?
Almost a decade.
With the Manichaeans, trying to find a rational explanation for evil and suffering.
What was the appeal of Manichaeism?
Well, it seemed neat. It proposed two cosmic powers.
Yeah.
Good, spirit, and evil, matter. Locked in eternal battle.
Yeah.
Sort of externalized evil. It wasn't his fault. It was this cosmic dark force acting on him. That's appealing when you're struggling with your own choices.
But it didn't satisfy him in the long run. He found their cosmology simplistic.
Yeah, intellectually thin, eventually. The breakthrough, the real game changer for him, came from Neoplatonism.
How so? What did Neoplatonism give him?
Two crucial things, really. First, the idea that ultimate reality, God, must be non-material, pure spirit. That helped him move beyond Manichaean and materialism. But second, and maybe even more important,
the definition of evil.
Exactly. Evil isn't a substance. It's not a thing fighting God. It's a privatio boni.
A privation of good. Like, darkness is just the absence of light.
Precisely. Yep. Evil is a lack, a distortion, a turning away from the good, which is God. It's a failure of the will, not an external power attacking.
Okay, that's huge. Because suddenly the responsibility shifts back inward. It's about his own will.
Absolutely. And that philosophical shift is what makes the Confessions possible. It sets the stage for that radical self-examination.
So let's talk about the Confessions. Chadwick calls it the first real autobiography in the West. Why? Because it's not just, here's what happened to me.
Right. It's psychological. It's an exploration of inner motives, memory, desire, failure. It's this intense dialogue with God, but also with himself. Deeply personal.
And it contains perhaps his most famous line, the one everyone knows, even if they don't know it's Augustine.
You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you.
That captures so much, doesn't it? That sense of longing, of incompleteness.
It really does. It speaks to that fundamental human condition, that searching quality. Whether you frame it theologically or psychologically, that restlessness feels very real.
And the Confessions is brutally honest about his own internal battles, the most famous being the struggle with his will, especially regarding chastity.
Oh, the prayer. Grant me chastity incontinence, but not yet.
I mean, who can't relate to that on some level? Wanting the good, but not quite being ready to give up the other thing.
It's perfect. He nails that feeling of the divided will, Part of him wants virtue, the higher calling. Another part is just stuck in habit, in immediate gratification. It's moral paralysis.
You know, it's interesting. That sounds incredibly modern, like understanding addiction or even just procrastination. Why do we do things we know aren't good for us?
Exactly. Augustine is analyzing that exact problem in the 4th century. And his conclusion, born from this painful self-awareness, was that his will wasn't truly free. Left to its own devices, it couldn't consistently choose the good. He felt powerless.
And that feeling of powerlessness, that reliance on something beyond himself, that's going to become central to his theology of grace.
It's the absolute core of it. His theology flows directly from this lived experience of struggle.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because this deeply personal stuff suddenly becomes public, almost weaponized, when he gets pushed into leadership.
That's a great way to put it. He didn't seek it out, apparently. He was sort of ambushed and made Bishop of Hippo around 395 CE.
So goodbye, quiet scholar life. Hello, messy church politics.
Totally. And he walks right into major controversies that forced him to apply these ideas about human nature and God's action to the real world, to the institution of the church.
First up, the Donatists in North Africa. What was their deal?
The Donatists were hardcore purists. They had split from the main church earlier, arguing that sacraments like baptism or ordination were invalid if the priest or bishop administering them had seriously sinned, especially during past persecutions.
So the minister's personal holiness determined if the sacrament worked?
Essentially, yes. For them, the church had to be a communion of saints, totally pure. If your minister wasn't pure, you weren't getting valid grace. They demanded perfection from the clergy and the institution.
And Augustine's response?
He pushed back hard. He argued the church on earth is not a museum for saints. It's more like a hospital for sinners. It's a corpus permixtum, a mixed body.
Wheat and weeds growing together, like the parable.
Exactly. Saints and sinners, side by side within the church. And crucially, he said the effectiveness of the sacrament comes from Christ. Ex autore operato, from the work performed, not from the moral worthiness of the human minister.
Okay, that protects the sacraments from the flaws of the clergy, but isn't there a risk there? Doesn't that potentially let corrupt leaders off the hook?
That's the tension, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Augustine wasn't saying the minister's sin didn't matter. He believed they'd face God's judgment, but he argued you couldn't make people's access to God's grace dependent on the variable virtue of human priests. That would lead to constant doubt and schism.
So he prioritized the reliability of grace and institutional stability over unattainable purity.
You could say that. It's a form of realism, maybe even mercy. It allows the institution to function despite human flaws. It's a really important idea for thinking about any large human organization, actually.
Okay, so Donatism was about the purity of the church. Then came Pelagius, and the fight shifted to the purity of human nature itself.
Right. Pelagius was a British monk, and he had a much more optimistic view of humanity. He basically argued that humans are born morally neutral. Adam's sin harmed only Adam.
So no original sin.
Not in the way Augustine understood it. Pelagius believed we have complete free will, totally unimpaired. We can choose good, follow God's law, and essentially earn salvation through our own efforts. Grace, for Pelagius, was helpful, like good advice or illumination, but not strictly necessary for salvation.
And Augustine, having wrestled with his own not yet prayer, must have just exploded.
Pretty much. Based on his own experience, that Pelagian optimism seemed naive, almost dangerously so. He knew his will wasn't neutral. It felt fundamentally bent towards self-interest, towards sin.
So his doctrine of original sin wasn't just theoretical. It was descriptive of his own inner life.
Deeply descriptive. He argued that humanity is affected by Adam's fall. Our nature is corrupted. Our will is in bondage to sin. We can't not sin left to ourselves.
So how do we escape? If our will is bound, are we just doomed?
This is where Augustine's doctrine of grace becomes absolutely central. He argued that we need prevenient grace, God's grace acting first, before we even desire the good to free the will and even initiate the desire for God. And then we need ongoing grace to sustain us.
So true freedom isn't free will in the Pelagian sense, but freedom from the compulsion to sin, which only grace gives.
Exactly. For Augustine, the highest freedom is actually the joyful inability to sin, which is the state of the blessed in heaven, made possible only by God's transformative grace.
Mm-hmm.
This whole debate cemented Augustine's status as the doctor of grace and profoundly shaped both Catholic and Protestant theology later on.
It's amazing how his personal psychology directly informs these massive theological frameworks. Okay, so he's dealing with himself, he's dealing with church splits, and then boom, the world itself seems to collapse. 410 AD, Rome gets sacked by the Visigoths.
A huge shock to the system. Rome, the eternal city, falling. People were terrified, and pagans started blaming Christians, saying, "See, you abandoned the old gods who protected Rome, and now look what happened."
And Augustine feels compelled to respond, which leads to his other giant work, The City of God.
Right. It's this sprawling masterpiece of history, theology, philosophy. But before we get fully into The City of God, Chadwick rightly points out, we need to appreciate Augustine's thinking on time, which he develops earlier in the Confessions.
Ah, yes. The famous bit where he says, essentially, "I know what time is until someone asks me to explain it."
It's brilliant because it captures the slipperiness of subjective experience.
Mm-hmm.
How do you define something so fundamental yet so hard to grasp?
Well, what was his conclusion?
He argues that time isn't really an external thing that flows independently. It exists primarily in the mind as a kind of stretching or distension of the soul. The past exists now only as memory. The future exists now only as expectation. And the present, well, that's immediate attention, perhaps almost instantaneous.
So time is fundamentally psychological, tied to our consciousness.
That was his groundbreaking insight. It links our perception of reality directly to our mental faculties. It really opened the door for centuries of philosophical pondering about time and consciousness.
Okay, so armed with that psychological depth, he tackles the fall of Rome in The City of God. How does he frame it?
He creates this powerful metaphor. Human history is the story of two cities, two invisible societies defined by their ultimate love. There's the earthly city, Civitas Terrena, founded on love of self, seeking earthly glory and power.
Think Rome, maybe, or any human empire focused on its own greatness.
Exactly. And then there's the heavenly city, Civitas Dei, founded on the love of God, seeking eternal peace. The crucial point is, these two cities are mixed together throughout history on Earth. You can't perfectly separate them in any earthly institution or nation.
So Christians live as citizens of the heavenly city, but temporarily reside within the flawed structures of the earthly city.
Precisely. And this was revolutionary. It allowed Christians to engage with the Roman state, or any state, obey its laws, work for peace and justice within it, because earthly peace is a relative good, even for pilgrims. But it also meant they should never give their ultimate allegiance to it or confuse its fate with God's ultimate plan.
That sounds like the seed of the idea of separation of church and state, almost. Don't confuse Caesar with God.
It's definitely foundational for that later development. It provides a theological basis for participating in secular society without idolizing it. It allows for political realism.
And running through all of this, the self-analysis, the church debates, the philosophy of history is his core approach to knowledge itself, right? Feeds querens intellectum.
Faith-seeking understanding, yes. For Augustine, faith isn't opposed to reason. It's the starting point. Faith provides the secure ground, the first principles, upon which reason can then explore, question, and deepen understanding of God and reality.
So they're partners. Faith illuminates, reason investigates.
That's the Augustinian model. It set the agenda for much of medieval thought and continues to influence how many people think about the relationship between belief and inquiry today.
So what does this all mean? Let's try to boil down some takeaways for us living now. What can we really pull from Augustine via Chadwick?
Well, one big one has to be that ethical principle he gives, love and do what you will.
Which sounds potentially chaotic, but Chadwick clarifies it's not licensed to do anything.
Not at all. It means if your fundamental orientation, your deepest love, is directed rightly towards God and neighbor, then your actions will naturally align with the good. The internal disposition of love becomes the ultimate guide, more fundamental than just following external rules. It's about the heart's direction.
That requires a lot of self-awareness, though,
yeah.
Which leads to the second point, his emphasis on introspection, the turn inward.
Definitely. In the inward, man dwells truth. He really pioneers the idea that self-knowledge is crucial not just for personal growth, but as a pathway to understanding deeper realities, even divine ones.
Mm-hmm.
Think about memory, motivation.
He validates things like journaling, therapy, any practice that involves serious self-reflection. The answers aren't all out there.
Right. The truth has an interior dimension, and that connects to the power of telling your own story like he did in the Confessions. Understanding your narrative is key.
And third, maybe that institutional realism we talked about, the hospital for sinners idea.
Yes, I think that's incredibly relevant. In an age that often demands ideological purity or perfection from groups, institutions, even ourselves, Augustine offers a more realistic, maybe more forgiving model.
Applicable to workplaces, communities, families, anywhere humans gather.
Absolutely. It suggests focusing on mission and mercy rather than trying to create a flawless museum of saints. It allows for failure and growth, which seems much more sustainable for any human group.
It seems his honesty about his own flaws allowed him to be more realistic about everyone else's.
I think that's exactly right. That radical self-honesty he achieved, especially in the confessions, didn't lead him to despair. Paradoxically, it opened the door for his understanding of grace and gave him a basis for resilient hope. It's that blend of clear-eyed realism about human brokenness, combined with profound hope in divine help, that makes him so compelling.
So let's leave you, our listener, with a final thought to maybe chew on. Augustine spent a lot of energy fighting the Donatists, who wanted this perfectly pure community, defined largely by who they kept out.
Right. Exclusion was key to their identity.
Okay, so think about today. Our culture often seems obsessed with purity, political purity, ideological purity, lifestyle purity. We see a lot of drawing lines, excluding people, creating us versus them in online spaces, in social circles, in politics.
Cancel culture, echo chambers.
So the question is, are we basically replaying that Donatist versus Augustine debate today? Is our modern drive for purity and perfection, for defining ourselves by who we exclude, actually making our communities less healthy, less realistic, maybe even less humane? Are we still tempted to build museums for saints instead of hospitals for sinners?
That's a powerful question. What does a truly healthy, realistic community look like in our time? Augustine's struggles certainly give us a lot to think about there. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.